You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Very, very excited to be here. My name is Harry Baker. I have come to Greenbelt almost every single year of my life. Last year, I came with a four-week-old baby. I'll be honest, I don't remember any of it, but I am still here and thrilled to be here. This weekend, I'm performing about 300 times, but this is the one that I'm most excited about. Full disclosure, I will say that at the other ones too, but this time I mean it. And that is because I was asked if I would do some things on the no-fly zone this year. And I have a podcast called Something Borrowed. Always leave a gap for the three listeners. And I started it during lockdown as a way of trying to connect with people when we couldn't gather in spaces in person. So it started off as an online thing. It was a chance for me and another performer to take it in turns to share something old, something new, something borrowed, and something blue. More recently, I've been doing it as a live event in Margate, but they said, come on, we got to wait for Margate. That's what we're here for. More people than the podcast. I don't take it personally. So the option to combine those two things to be able to get any guest I could possibly want in the world and invite them to come on was too much to resist with your beautiful live self. So what's going to happen is I'm going to start off by doing a poem. I'm going to introduce our guest who's going to share a poem. Then we're going to have a chat and you're going to be here being beautiful and wonderful the whole time. Does that sound good? Yeah. Fantastic. So this poem is called Sunflowers. I wrote it when, in the space of a month, two of my wife's grandparents died, and I went to their funerals, and I realized they were people I had got to know much later on in their lives. And being at their funerals, they got to hear from people who had known them the whole time, and it was an honor to hear about the people they've been throughout, but also deeply sad to think that we don't celebrate each other enough while we're still here. So my takeaway from that was to, one, try and celebrate my friends as much as possible while they were still here to fear it, but also to try and sort of plan ahead to what might happen when I die. So this is simply instructions upon my death. Ideally, I would like 100 benches, every single one of them facing the sea. If that's too much faff, I'd settle for the one somewhere in Margate, somewhere you can come and sit and think and be. And I don't need a fancy pot to keep my ashes. Just find a decent spot where there's a breeze. So the next time someone gasps at all the wonder in the world, a part of them is breathing in a part of me. And at my funeral, I'd like there to be sunflowers, a truly inconvenient amount. For I too will have spent a lifetime searching for the light. I don't see a reason why I should stop now. Wear what you want. If it were me, I'd go for trainers or wellies. Something comfortable and colourful to match. For as it was foretold by the prophet Jamie Tart, dress shoes are for muggles and for twats. For the reading, I'd like Erin's poem about final moments. Maybe this poem should be read for context too. And for the music, nothing short of a full-throated sing-along of my favourite song, Dynamite by Teo Cruz. For the food, just keep it veggie. For the drink, serve up Negronis. If I pretend to like them, you can do the same. And for the wake, if people want to chat, then I am all for that. But just in case, make sure a corner's stacked with games. And don't let anyone apologize for crying. It is honestly my favorite thing to do. Just make sure everybody knows how much I loved being alive. The only thing that I loved more was loving you. Speaking of which, if you are free, then I would love for you to be there. But if you can't, because you're dead, that's not your fault. To be honest, neither of us quite makes sense without the other. I still think we'll die together like a cult. And if anybody says I have gone to a better place, that is a kind and very well-intentioned lie. For there can be no better place than in a room with all my friends. Just promise we'll do this again the other side. Side note, let's also do this loads before we die. And by the time it comes around, maybe I'd hate it. I live for ages and these tastes will change with time. But one thing that I know that I will always find amazing is what a thing it is to live a life. P.S. Let's also do this loads before we die. Thank you so much. Can everyone hear me sat down? Glorious. So speaking of living our life before we die, speaking of hanging out with friends, I'm so excited to meet this person for the first time, even though we've become sort of internet friends, we're all going to sort of have a group meeting with hundreds of people, which I think is how everyone should meet each other. I am so excited to introduce to you Lindsay Rush, who is one of my favourite poets I've discovered over the past few years. You may know her more as her Instagram handle, which is Mary Oliver's Drunk Cousin. If you don't know her, that should be enough to get you on board. So I'm going to bring her on and ask her to share a poem with you so you can all fall in love with her yourselves. And then we will have a chat and go back and forth with some poems. Does that sound good? Fantastic. In which case, can you all put your hands together, cheer, whoop and holler, and welcome to the screen and the stage, Lindsay Rush.
Harry, hi.
Hi.
Oh my goodness. I was crying. You read the poem that makes me cry. So that's a great way to get me started.
It is so lovely to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Are you up for sharing your something old? And then I want to ask you lots of questions.
Yes, I am. And my something old is just as serious and heart-wrenching as your something old. So this is called She's a Bit Much, and it is the poem that sort of changed my life, turned me into a poet, I guess, got me a book deal. The book then was called A Bit Much. So this is a pretty sweet poem to me. She's a bit much. You mean like a bonus French fry in the bottom of the bag? Like a champagne shower? Like triple texting good news? Like buying coffee for the person behind you in line? Or did you mean a bit much, like an unexpected upgrade to business class or theme parties or the band pretending to go off stage and then coming back for an unforgettable encore? Perhaps you were referring to that thing of being astonished by a sunset or how puppies flop around when they learn to run or the way some people take karaoke really seriously. Maybe you just meant sprinkles, confetti, balloon drops, witty comebacks, generous tips, fireworks, water slides, serotonin, cherries on top, and the fact that maybe we were put on this planet simply to enjoy ourselves, then yes, I agree. She is a bit much. Aren't we so lucky she's here?
Oh, aren't we so lucky you're here? you say this is the poem that sort of changed things for you. How did you go from someone who describes himself as not really being into poetry to not only writing poems but sharing them in a very public space and then having a book, and hopefully now you see yourself as a poet because you are fantastic? But how was that journey for you? Because I know you have a background in kind of comedy writing.
Yeah.
What was the journey that got you here?
I mean, I think it was COVID brain a little bit. It was being in lockdown and having a lot of time on my hand and a lot of emotions, I guess. And I wish I could remember the reason I decided to try writing a poem. Like you said, I've been doing comedy for a long time, and I just decided to take a joke that I thought was funny that I had written and add on to it and see what else could be true, what else could be funny about this. And once I started, I sort of couldn't stop. And for better or worse, I'm the type of person who shares things before they're ready. So probably the lag time between my writing my first like adult poem and starting that Instagram was probably a week. I was just like, let's see. Maybe this gal's on to something. Like, I am admittedly one of my own biggest fans. I blame my mother, but I just was like, maybe this is good. And then slowly but surely people started agreeing with me.
And how early on did you come across Mary Oliver's Drunk Cousin as a kind of persona, vibe,
yeah,
signpost towards what you were going for?
So I knew that if I was going to start, I wanted to start a dedicated Instagram that wasn't my personal Instagram, because I was like, I don't need people I went to high school with or distant relatives reading these poems if I don't know if they're good yet or at all. And so I knew I wanted to have a funny handle so that people right away could know what I was all about, that this is supposed to be semi-serious, half funny, half, you know, heartfelt. And I dabbled with a lot of things, and Mary Oliver's Drunk Cousin was just, to me, the funniest. And I have, of all the, I did not know a ton about poetry when I began, but I knew Mary Oliver, of course. And so I was like, what if I'm sort of like her irreverent drunk cousin at the family barbecue. And she's talking about, you know, wild geese and nature. And I'm talking about nail art and potato chips with hopefully the same level of curiosity and astonishment. So I don't usually love jokes that rely on alcohol or like, you know, like I was like, that's sort of, is that a lazy joke? And I dabbled with Dollar Store Mary Oliver. And I dabbled with a couple other things. And to me, Mary Oliver's drunk cousin just won. And it sort of, yeah, helped people know what they were in for right off the bat.
Amazing. And I think what I love is your sense of humor and skill in comedy writing comes through. But there is also that space for that astonishment. I think, again, I feel like I came into poetry sideways more from the sort of performance sphere where I would just see people and they would give me goosebumps or they would make me laugh or make me cry, ideally like all of them at the same time. And I would come across people who, once I started calling myself a poet, would be like, oh, you know, how do you feel about Sigrid Sassoon? And I'd be like, I don't know who that is. And it was kind of almost be like a sense of embarrassment. Or someone asked me, I was at a poetry gig and someone did a sort of really somber performance of, I think it was The Last Post or some kind of World War II poem. And they were like, oh, what did you think? And I just said, oh, I don't really like war. And they were mortified because, like, here at school you learn poetry through war poetry because it is something that is big and heavy and therefore worthy of that gravitas. And I think since then I've come to appreciate how poetry can capture those big moments, but I think it is also just as valid and important in capturing those small moments as well. And so I think what I love about being a poet is that people don't expect it to be funny, and so it's then almost like a nice bonus and a nice surprise. Whereas when I was doing gigs that were labeled as comedy, they would be like, why is this rhyming? Or it's kind of it's not as generous the other way around. Whereas I think what I love about poetry and spoken word is it's this kind of broad term of basically talking a bit about your feelings, and that is kind of enough of a scope for everything. When you started writing, did you have a view that it would just be about this kind of whimsical everyday nature, or was it just anything that was on your mind? Because I think your poetry has a lightness to it, but it also has a depth to it. How much of that is intentional from the start versus just what's developed over time, I guess?
Yeah, I think at the beginning, I was just writing whatever was coming to my mind. I was looking at old jokes. I was looking at old satire articles. And then I think I put She's a Bit Much on my Instagram. Maybe it was 6 months after starting the account. And that seeing how much that resonated with women who had been hurt by that phrase, or who, you know, that calling someone a bit much is typically negative, obviously, and used, I think, historically to diminish women and tell them they're too loud, too bossy, too much. And seeing this sort of audience grow of women who wanted permission maybe to be all of who they were and to be loud or not, and to not be made to feel that joy is silly. That I think after this poem, I started realizing that that was something that was really, really true to me, that I could write about 1,000 times over.
Incredible. I think for me, I'm both grateful and sort of surprised that a year or two ago, a couple of my poems started getting shared much more widely online. And this was after I'd already had 10 years of writing and performing. And I feel like there was this huge breadth to what I talked about, but it was almost seeing it through other people's eyes that I realized there are these common themes in my work of, similarly to what you say, of joy and of hope, not as these kind of afterthoughts, but as this kind of core, essential, important thing. But I found it fascinating when it was me reading a poem by Donna Ashworth called Joy Chose You that is about 45 seconds long and absolutely stunning, and for whatever reason just like struck the note that people needed to hear at that moment. got shared to like millions of people. And the next thing I was planning on putting online was a song that I had just written about my favorite sort of German beer. And I had a real moment of thinking, not yet. I need to, like, all of these new people who are here for, like, sincere joy, I need to, like, get them on board with my vibe a bit before I can take them to the other side of Harry Baker that is just, like, purely silly for the sake of it. And I think it's an interesting thing when people find you through one particular poem or one particular thing that then becomes the lens through which they see you. Because initially, the first thing I shared that went online was a TED talk where I talked about being a math student. So for a long time, I was the maths poet. And then I was getting booked for coding conventions and struggling to fill a half an hour set. And so I think it's interesting, like these, you know, and even the poem I shared at the start is one of the first times I've talked about death. And that's because that's the stage of life that I'm in now. And so for me, it felt really powerful, important to be able to do that. But in my mind, that's one of my most serious poems. Whereas still performing it at gigs, I realize it still has these big laugh moments in there because I can't resist breaking the tension or kind of putting that added flavor to it because I don't think it has to be one or the other. And I think that's kind of the joy of it.
Yeah, I have a poem in the book that is called Cracks of Light. And it's probably one of the only poems that doesn't have a humor moment. So I was very uncomfortable with that. Because to me, it's sort of, I feel like the two markers for me to know that a poem is maybe ready to go, ready to hit it, is a funny title and a punchline. I want there to be an element of surprise. I want it to take someone somewhere they didn't think they were going. And then I want, of course, I just love the freedom to have the stupidest titles I possibly can. So I went back and forth with my editor. I wanted to retitle it, Butt Cracks of Light, for no reason. Simply because the urge in me was, I need to hide behind a little bit of humor because this one is very earnest. And she was like, there's nothing even about butts in there, Lindsay. And I was like, but, you know. And so I lost the battle, which is good because it would make no sense. It is some people, it is about going through a hard time and finally seeing, you know, a little sliver of light, which is a crack. Anyway, so I could have fought harder, but I let it go. But I relate to that need. I do think, though, humor greases the wheels on understanding things. I think novelty and surprise, hearing something that you relate to and resonate with in a way that you hadn't heard it before, I think really does something to the brain. As a doctor, I'm not a doctor, but I feel like something fires up when you're surprised that helps it sink in.
And I think particularly when, I guess these, when online spaces are becoming more and more curated to individuals, so people are seeing things that they already agree with or that they already think that they want to be shown. Again, I think if you can, so many people love telling me how much they hate poetry, but I think if it's come up on their feed unexpectedly and it's moved them or it's made them think or it's made them stop in their tracks, suddenly you think, oh, okay, that's not what I was expecting. And actually that has sat with me more than something that I was expecting to like and that kind of thing. And I think similarly, it is such a gift to be able to make people think. And again, I used, in terms of knowing when a poem's ready to go, for me, it wasn't until I'd performed it out loud and I'd felt like it had connected with people. And I think it's easy to tell when a joke connects because people laugh. Whereas when a thoughtful poem connects, you can feel a weight to that silence, or you can hopefully make someone in the front row cry and tell. But I think in general, you have to trust it more. And I had a real sense during COVID and lockdown, when you didn't have that live performance space, I had to start trusting my own writing more because I couldn't test it to an audience. All I could do was sort of perform it to my wife and say, is this good? And there's only so many ways she can say, you're doing really well, darling. yeah, for me, doing something new, because I want to ask you about your titles because I think they are the best. And I aspire to have better poetry titles because of you. So this poem is called we all used to be babies, but I wanted to call it, at some point, someone looked down at their child and called them Gary Oldman. The year is 1958. Jamie Lee Curtis has just filled her nappy again. Ursula von der Leyen is currently trying to eat some soap. Angela Bassett, Queen of Wakanda, is shrieking with laughter at her own reflection. Kevin Bacon cries as his mum heading out proves to be 1 degree of separation too many. Gary Oldman has not yet grown into his name. Gary Newman feels far more appropriate. An artist has been born who is yet to be known as Prince. Kate Bush has only just started to think about crawling up that hill. Benjamin Zephaniah is yet to talk to any turkeys. Both Madonna and Michael Jackson are soon to hear music for the first time. Donald Trump has got stuck trying to reach his favourite toy under the sofa. Unlike the others, he is 12 years old at this point. So arguably should know better. Meanwhile, having woken up for the third time in as many hours, refusing to be put down when only the arms of a parent will do, with patience and tenderness and without a second thought, Sandy Toksvig is rocked gently back to sleep. Are you up for doing something new? And then I will ask you more about it. Thank you.
I am. I think I'm just going to read it. I'm not going to talk about it. This is called, "As a Little Girl, I Always Dreamed of Collaborating in Google Docs." Sorry if I've been acting weird the last few decades. It's just that I was born to dilly-dally, but I've been forced to hurry-scurry. I was made to trade seashells for blueberries, poppies for pine cones, stories for songs, while everyone I love sits around the same fire. But instead, here I am with the entire world in my pocket, waiting for more news to break us, hoping your email never finds me.
I was so happy when you said you were going to do that one. I love that poem so much. I think it might even be in the introduction to your book, you talk about a poem as being a joke with an epilogue, and I've never thought of it as that description. Do your titles come first, or is it afterwards that you want to add them in? How is that process for you?
You know, I feel like they usually come first-ish in the sense of, I'm like, oh, that word has a double meaning that would be fun to play with. Or like, I could write about that topic, or I'll jot down a dumb joke I said, or I'll look back in Twitter drafts. But then, because if I ever have to do it in reverse, and I share these often online, I'll just have this insane brain dump of truly unhinged thoughts. And I get to the point where I'm like, is that anything? And you're like, no, that's an in-sync lyric. That's not, you know, but then sometimes I'm like, well, that works. So it sort of depends, but I know I'm always of the mind that a title is a perfect place to really go crazy, because that hooks people in and you just have a little freedom there, because then the meat of it can be more serious.
And I think I, again, come from this background of slam poetry, where you have sort of 3 minutes on stage to perform everything that you can. So a lot of my earlier poems are all almost exactly 3 minutes long, so I want to kind of make the most of it. But that kind of means that there's so much in the poem itself, by the end the title just ends up being like the main theme. So it's like the Wellies poem or the dinosaur poem or whatever it is. And whereas in my new collection coming out, there are, it's 100 poems from the first 100 days of my son's life. So some of them are sort of 2 lines long or 4 lines long. And so suddenly it feels like the title can't be something that's included in the poem, because that then uses up half of the poem already. So then it's almost thinking about like, what is another way to say this thing? But I love the idea of it being, you know, almost the heart of the poem or the kernel, and then thinking, how can I push this thought either to its like logical extreme or even sort of slightly further than that? And so that poem just then, for so long, it was in my drafts just as, it's weird that we were all babies. Or I think at some point, the opening line was just, Emma Thompson has shat herself. And I thought, I can't commit that to print. That feels unkind. But it was that kind of like jarring nature and thought. And it was only with sitting with it for long enough that you think there's something in this more than just the idea of a national treasure poo in their pants, you know, and it's kind of trying to find the heart in it as well. And I think with a lot of my poems, it feels like it's almost the opposite, where it starts with the heart and it starts with kind of that essential idea of what I want to say. And then once I'm in it, the humour will naturally come in later as a way to kind of offset it. But I love the idea of starting with either the joke or the moment of kind of thinking sideways and then pushing that further and seeing, because I think for so long as well, I used to love puns, and the idea of wordplay not just being to make someone laugh, you know, how can you do a sad pun, or, you know, that kind of idea. Yeah. And I think that's a really fascinating thing.
If anyone can do it, you and me. Let's make some sad puns.
We got the sad pun market down. And I guess having just finished like a whole selection of poems written in quite a short space of time, I know for you, from having like this one poem go massive, people approaching you, to a whole book of poems, I think especially when I started as well, it just came so naturally. I didn't even have to think about it. I was like, I can go forever. And then as soon as I finished studying and called myself a poet, I was sort of like, oh, but what happens if I haven't got any poems? Who am I, kind of thing? So was it helpful for you then having a book to work towards in terms of like squeezing the poems out of you? Or was that then an added pressure that didn't exist at the start?
Yeah, I think it was overwhelming to think that I needed to write all of this new stuff for a book that I couldn't share online while still writing enough new stuff to have an audience that would eventually buy the book. So you know this, when you're an author, you're like, oh, I'm everything. I'm the entire marketing department. I mean, you have a publisher that helps, but you're running the ship. So I did have a bunch of stuff sort of in the tank that I had never shared that I could clean up for the book, but it did help me because it gave me permission or a reason to sort of explore topics that weren't coming naturally because they weren't true to the season of life I was in. So I think when I got the book deal, I was a newlywed, did not have a child yet. But so I didn't write a lot about dating, for example. But that was a huge part of my life. I was single all of my 20s and a large part of my 30s. So I got to go back and go, what was true for me then and what was funny and what do I remember? So it was fun to sort of explore topics that wouldn't have naturally been on my mind. But it is a whole different beast when you realize now people are expecting me to do this thing. And since I didn't seek to be an author, I didn't go out to write this book. I just wanted to write longer jokes sort of that were true. And so I had to ask myself, I was like, I know this is great. This has come to me. I feel like this is right to put these in a book, but this was supposed to be a fun project. And these were just supposed to be a writing exercise and a way to play out loud. So I grappled with that a little bit. I'm glad I did it. But for a while I was like, this suddenly there's this pressure where at one point I didn't think twice about what I was putting online or what I was writing, you know?
And you mentioned that you didn't have a child at the time, you now do. Is that something you've been writing about as well? Or does that feel off limits? Have you got another book in you? What's sort of next for you?
Yeah, I found myself writing. As soon, like pregnancy and then postpartum, I could not stop writing. But then a lot of it felt really raw. A lot of it felt really precious. And so at first the natural thing was, okay, book number two is going to be all about motherhood. But then I was like, by the time this book comes out, I will have been a mother for what, 3 years. So it didn't feel like I was an expert, not that you have to be. And so I think the plan for book number two would be more about life changing in transition moments. And I'm 40 and like that sort of middle of life grappling with the freedom and sorrow of invisibility or irrelevancy that sort of comes with being a woman growing older. So I'm very fascinated in all of that. And I hope to speak to people in that stage of life, whether or not they have children, but there will certainly be books about motherhood in there because that is the that was a big transitional season for me.
I remember having such a sense of, before my son was born, I felt like I was in tune with my audience in terms of when I wrote something, I had a pretty good sense of how well it would connect with people. And then it would be on stage that I would find out if that was true or not. And then I would hone it and kind of do it that way. But especially in those early days, I was so obsessed with my son. Anything he did was just the best. And anything I wrote about him was the most emotional thing I'd ever felt. And I just had no idea if anyone else would care. And then it felt like such a risk to share any of that, because if I shared this really precious thing and it was completely meaningless to someone else, did that then ruin the initial moment that it was written about? And how do you find that balance of trying to speak about your personal experience and trying to do it in a way that people can relate to, whether or not they've had that same experience? And I think it was through early versions of these poems, and also just like a bit later on, having had some sleep was helpful, but trying to kind of figure out there is a universality to it, even when it's such a specific thing that is happening to you and you feel like you're the only person who's ever gone through this, and you're not, but it's only in the sharing that you kind of discover this and find this out. And even as you're speaking, there is such a broadness to it. And like you say, some of that is about having kids, some of that isn't. But it's only once you start. And again, I think reading your collection, so many of the poems just grab me as individuals, but it's only once you read them as part of a collection that you realize there are themes there and there are kind of things coming through. And again, I always used to think that I just wrote about everything, and it's only when you see things side by side you realize that these must be the things that are important to you, because they keep coming up and they keep sort of coming out.
Yeah, I was on an interview when the book came out last fall, and the interviewer said, tell me about why you write so much about body image. And I said, I do. I am not. And sure enough, there's tons of books in here about, you know, body and beauty and all of that stuff. But I think you do end up just writing so much of what's true to you, and maybe you yourself don't even always notice the themes. So I was like, oh yeah, that's true.
I think particularly when you write about things and speak about things that perhaps other people don't speak about freely, that it's a gift to people and it gives them permission as well. But also that's something that perhaps feels just natural to you. And it's only again when someone else picks it out that you think, oh, okay, yeah. Most men don't talk about crying at the Lego movie or whatever it is, whereas I'm just like, that is a Tuesday morning for me. And it's that kind of thing where, again, it's so much of it in the sharing is where I think that kind of connection is made and is completed. And what I find fascinating is, for me, that used to be entirely in person at gigs, whereas now online feels as much a part of that process and that community. And it's not to say that whether a poem gets lots of views online or not means it's a better poem, but it's about what people connect with and what they want to see, and it's just another kind of lens to see it through.
I think so too. I think you can look at sharing work online in a couple different ways, but for me that reverb is important. And it's not, like you said, it's not about numbers, but even if there were three people that commented, I've always felt that way and never had the words, or I've never thought about it that way. Like, just to even, I think, go, maybe that's not one of my best, but what I was trying to say made sense to somebody or helped them in some way. And I can't imagine. And like I said at the beginning of this, I like to just throw spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks, but I can't imagine doing it all in a silo. And then, so I do think the internet can be just a great place for that.
And I used to not let anyone see anything until it was like done, until it felt bulletproof, because then I was like, then they'll get it. I've put enough work in it, because if they see an early draft and don't get it, I'll lose confidence and want to sort of throw it in the bin. And it's partly through necessity, partly through trying to write 100 poems at once, that I've just learned to share the early drafts too and trust that I'm not good at performing these yet. So they're not their final versions, but I'll be able to tell enough if they've got legs or if it feels like they're able to go. Are you up for me doing something borrowed?
Yeah.
Fantastic. So this, we've done 4 seasons of this as a podcast, and this is a Something Borrowed exclusive where I've borrowed the poem from the guest who's currently on the show. So I hope this isn't too awkward for you, but it's partly because I love your poems and I want people to hear them as much as possible, and also because I'm conscious of how long my poems are, so I want yours to get more airtime. So this is called Out on a Whim by a fantastic poet called Lindsay Rush. Every morning I take a deep breath of hope and horror and exhale. My phone is full of hot air and outside it's worse. But still, I know we are not limited to either and or outrage or apathy. Histrionics or hibernation, all or nothing. We are knit for nuance and hardwired for joy. I, even in the face of atrocity, perhaps especially in the face of atrocity, look for the helpers, yes, but look too for the dreamers. Look for the hopeful. Look for the artists and the noticers, those clawing their way towards peace and even pleasure amidst news that keeps breaking and breaking and breaking. If hatred is the hare, not the tortoise, if rage burns twice as bright but half as long, then let me be bolstered by whimsy. If empathy is extreme and joy is an act of resistance, then dear God, let me be radicalized by whimsy. What could be finer fuel for our fight? What could better remind us of our humanity? What could possibly sustain us but this? I was trying not to make eye contact while I did it. I don't want to be too intense. I don't know how much you know about Green Belt Festival, but the theme for this year is hope in the making. And that poem feels so true to that. And that idea that joy is a radical act and these things are important and essential as part of the wider fight for justice and what is good. So I love that poem. Thank you for letting me do it. Are you up for doing something borrowed?
I am. This is by a poet called Victoria Hutchins, and it's called For Arguments with Someone You Love. Like every storm, it starts with one stupid drop, an overflowing garbage can, a bad joke, your sneakers on the white couch like you know I hate. Then cloud 9 evaporates and tenderness gets thrown to the wind. My tongue spits lightning that rattles our apartment, and your eyes roll back thunder that scares the dog. But even under our darkest skies, eventually the sweet gleam in your eye always catches the light. And as soon as it does, I always remember, you're cold and wet too. So what do you say we skip to after the storm? I'll bottle my lightning if you patch up our cloud silver lining. Let's jump to the petrichor, the glassy pavement. You and me, hand in hand on the porch, assessing the damage. A few trees down, some shingles missing from the roof, par for the course. Nothing we can't fix. All things considered, right as rain.
F- Thank you so much. As someone who shares your work online and on Instagram, is that where you also discover other poets, or how does that work in terms of, is there a community that you feel you've inserted yourself within or are a part of? Where is your kind of inspiration from, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, it's how I found you. It's almost all Instagram. People share and send. I mean, when I, the poem that you read at the beginning of this, I just stopped and I was like, I need to know more about this person. And similarly, Victoria Hutchins is a poet. She's in Canada somewhere, I believe. We met online, and I feel like you know this about writing books. Everybody starts asking you for blurbs, and you're like, oh, here's a new poet. And let me read, you know, which is, I know it's part of the game. It's just a funny thing. You sort of end up, like, by my bedside is just stacks and stacks of poetry books. And so you do end up getting, you're like, oh, I'm getting all these books in the mail, and I'm learning all about poets. I did not know how many of us were out there. There's probably one around you right now if you look around. We're everywhere.
Another thing I wanted to ask about is, I want to get the line right because I love it so much. In that poem, it's, "Dear God, let me be radicalized by whimsy," which, I mean, I almost want as a tattoo. But in a few of your poems, I feel like what gets me so much is there is this kind of religious language that, again, is this basis that's then given this new permission and given this kind of sideways tilt. How is that for you? Have you got that as a background? Is it something that you're sort of running away from, taking with you? How intentional is that, I guess? Because it really jumps out to me.
Another topic that I'm writing about a lot. So I grew up in a very conservative Christian family, and I probably stuck with exact type of religion until I was in my mid-20s. So I was on board. I was a little Christian soldier for a while. I started sort of opening my eyes to something, sort of stopped feeling so certain in black and white about the things I had felt very certain in black and white my whole life. And so when I started writing poetry, it came very naturally to sort of explore that doubt that I didn't feel had a safe place in the religious structure that I grew up in. And the more that I could freely explore my doubt, the more beautiful my newfound sense of faith became. And so I found that I could develop that on my own terms and think of God in a different way. And yeah, so, and then of course there's some hurt there that it comes across that I use jokes to sort of soften. And it just is such a big part of my life that it was just inevitable that now that it has changed, I'm just wanting to like dismantle and grapple and poke it in the ribs and see what happens.
Found, especially early on, I would talk about being a poet and being a Christian in the same way that it would come with loads of caveats. So I'd be like, oh, I'm a Christian, but not like that. You know, I don't hate the gays. And it would be like, oh, I'm a poet, but not like that. I'm not really boring. And that was partly like my own like insecurities about what I was projecting onto those things, and also wanting to kind of, but the only way I could define myself was by being other to these existing things. So I feel like it's still these kind of labels that people have and why people are put off by poetry and these kind of things. And I realize it's only more recently that I'm more comfortable in myself, in my own writing, in my own faith, that I'm able to kind of lean into these labels without saying yeah, but, and just sort of trusting that people will not hate me, or, you know, that they'll kind of like take it as it's given. And I think the idea of poetry being a way to lean into the doubt or explore the faith side of it, as opposed to kind of black and white. Because again, I think the only when I see poetry that is explicitly faith-based, it, for me, it almost feels too certain, or it kind of, you know, that to have that room for doubt, I think is, again, such a generous thing to give your audience as well.
I think also what I love about poetry that I discovered as I accidentally became one, a poet, is that you don't have to have all of the answers. Whereas, you know, if I were to write essays or a memoir on the deconstruction of my faith, I feel like you would be more inclined to have to say, and then this is what I now believe, or then, and that's why fill in the blank. And I think I found myself writing about God and religion so much because I was able to end on a, and I don't know, or a what if, or a dot, 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 or could this be true? Maybe yes, maybe no. My friend and poet, Joy Sullivan, says, she says, I'm a poet, not a preacher. And I think about that a lot in the sense of when I'm writing and I feel the inclination to say, well, what am I teaching somebody, or what am I really telling them with this? And I think whenever I feel the need for that to be overt, it is always a sign to me that I don't need to do that. You know, like, it doesn't have to say, and that's why you should, you know, live a life full of doubt. You know, you don't, it, the inclination to tie it up neatly in the way that a joke what is set up punchline. That's what poetry gives me, all of this messy middle and room to breathe, and leave it up to people.
One of my favorite writers and poets is Kay Tempest. And I was at a workshop that they were giving, and they were talking about performance in particular. And they said that being a poet is like being a map maker. You can give someone this route, but you can't force them to go down it. And again, for so long, I was so worried about people not getting my poems, or people like not understanding every like clever joke that I'd made, or even just like taking something else from it that I hadn't intended. You know, the same way that we study poetry in school from hundreds of years ago, and we're putting in these meanings that may or may not have been there. But there was something very freeing and releasing about saying, actually, I'm putting this out there. People can take what they want from it. And there's no wrong way to read a poem or hear a poem. There is a way that is different to what I intended. And every, even as I say that, I'm screaming, which is wrong, but that's not. And I am learning to kind of give up. And I think for me, putting it in print is part of that process. Because again, when I'm in a room with people, I can sort of signpost a bit more about, like, I want you to laugh now because I'm looking very needy, or like, this is a serious bit because I'm avoiding eye contact because otherwise I'll cry, and those kind of like personal cues. Whereas I think on paper, people might be reading it on the toilet, people might be reading it, you know, with a soundtrack that makes it more emotional. I don't know if anyone does that, but that kind of sense of, yeah, leaning in, so I'm giving up. I'm aware of time, and so I'm going to do my Something Blue, so there's still time for you to do yours. And this one is from day 50 of my 100 poems. And it's Something Blue because it is dedicated to my uncle, who is in hospital at the moment, and he gets a mention in this. My grandma has always been great, but now your existence has made it official. My aunts and uncles have all been upgraded too. Overnight, my parents' titles have been elevated to grand. Meanwhile, your mum's mum isn't fully embracing her Nana rebrand. One uncle says he would prefer to be referred to as the greatest uncle. More than one aunt says they'd rather not be called great, it just makes them feel old. As if we're not celebrating you making it to the next week, let alone generation. As if it is anything less than amazing to be here to welcome the next cohort in. As if we ourselves have not exclaimed, how did you get so old, baby? Now that you have reached the distinguished age of 50 whole days in this world. As if we are not still counting your age in days, because to measure your life in years at this point would be to suggest it had not yet begun. As if growing and growing old are not two of the biggest adventures we have. As if I wouldn't give anything for you to one day call me a great dad. Thank you. so much.
So tender.
Are you up for doing Your Something Blue? Which, not to give a spoiler, I feel like combines the talk of faith and great titles.
So one caveat, this whole time, I thought blue meant like blue comedy, like as in raunchy. So I picked my Something Blue, not blue as in sad. So this one has heart, but is, rated PG-13. I've listened to your podcast. I don't know why it didn't click. I mean, you were like, my Something Blue is about my uncle who's, you know, going through a time. And I was like, I like midway through this, I like the like 5 minutes in, I was like, oh no. Okay, I'm gonna read. This is called Resurrectile Dysfunction. this is so bad. In 2013, I could no longer get it up, my spirits or my faith. The only solution, as I saw it, was to lie down. I've always been very good in bed. So I did exactly that, subsisting on wine and bread until the stench of decaying dogma dissipated entirely. When I was ready to resurrect, I revealed myself to the women first. They listened to my story, took account of my scars, proclaimed me new again. Reborn, some might say. And when asked about my life-saving miracle, my unsalvation, their report was simple. She hath risen. She hath risen indeed.
Thank you so, so much. I honestly can't think of a better note to end it on. That is completely perfect. You have been so warm and generous, both with your poetry and your conversation. Thank you. One day we will meet in person, I'm certain of it. But until then, we'll just sort of meet with hundreds of people watching us in the fields and we can keep doing it like this.
My favorite way to hang out.
Exactly. So thank you so much. Can we give it up one more time for the fantastic Lindsay Rush?
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.